Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. While the number of cases of the COVID-19 or coronavirus pandemic continue to grow in the U.S. and Pennsylvania, WITF Smart Talk focuses on many aspects of the illness and the nation's response to it. Smart Talk is committed to providing context and answering questions during these extraordinary times. On today's Smart Talk, we'll discuss the critical need for blood from donors, how Pennsylvania's restaurants that are shut down except for pickup and delivery are faring, and how funerals are different due to the outbreak and social distancing. Across the country, more than 4,000 blood drives have been canceled, resulting in some 130,000 fewer blood donations due to coronavirus concerns. That's according to the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank, which supplies blood to 23 hospitals in 10 counties. Joining us is Patrick Bradley, President and CEO of the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank. Mr. Bradley, welcome to the program. Also joining us is Jay Weimer, Director of Community Relations of the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank. Mr. Weimer, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is Patrick Bradley there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there you go. All right, you scared us there for just a moment. If you have a question or comment about blood donations, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532.
Blood is an essential part of healthcare, and the need for blood is constant. In the United States, a patient is treated with a blood transfusion every 2 seconds.
Patrick Bradley, I wonder how many Americans actually realize that a blood transfusion is needed every 2 seconds in this country.
Scott, I don't think a lot of Americans really realize it until someone in their family needs a blood transfusion. It seems very foreign to most individuals, even people that I speak to, but I can tell you it has impacted my family's life greatly. Both my mother and my father had many extra years of life with us because of blood being available for their needs following my father's heart operation and following my mother's cancer treatments. So I'm very aware of it personally and also professionally, but I wish we could get that information out to the public more than we possibly can. So thank you for having us on today.
Well, thank you for being on, because this is a situation that there is so much news right now about coronavirus and COVID-19 that sometimes some of these things get lost a little bit. Is there a shortage of blood right now?
There is a shortage of blood. And the reason why there is a shortage is because there is so much other background news on the pandemic. People are concerned. People are frightened. High schools and colleges are closed. We rely on our blood drives out in the public to collect about 74% of our blood supply. And our buses and vans have sat idle since about the middle of last week because all the schools were closed and colleges were closed, and many businesses, non-essential businesses, are also closed. So we have changed some things around, and our website has detailed information of how you can donate, and it would be great if people come out and donate, and perhaps Jay could speak to some of the things he and his group is doing to make blood donation safe and easy for our donors.
Okay, well, yeah, we're going to jump around a little bit. Jay Weimer, talk about that a little bit, because what's happened here, as Patrick just described, is that very often there are people here in Central Pennsylvania and across the country that they donate blood at your blood mobile or when there are blood drives, but people are staying home. They've been told, stay home, don't gather in crowds of more than 10. So how can people donate blood right now?
Well, some things that Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank has done, along with blood centers across the country, is we are moving blood drives that used to be held on the blood mobiles into buildings. And we are directing people to our blood donor centers. We are asking people to schedule appointments rather than just walk into our donor centers. And this gives us the ability to provide proper social distancing in our donor centers. We have, of course, implemented additional sanitizing steps to our already rigorous cleaning process. And we have a new scheduling program, as I said, where we're only scheduling two donors every 30 minutes. And this gives us the ability to make sure that folks can still come out but be safely distanced from each other.
All right, when you say that you're scheduling donors every 30 minutes, that still slows down the process and probably doesn't generate, or you don't realize, as much blood as what you would normally in a blood drive, right?
Very, very true. Very true. But Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank is obviously, just as everyone else is, very concerned about blood donor safety as well as patient safety. So we have to move forward safely and carefully. And yes, that is less donors than we normally see to ensure safety.
You said that you already have a rigorous sanitation, keeping the area, the blood mobile or wherever blood is being donated, clean and safe. What have you done? What are some extra steps that you have done?
We are sanitizing different pieces of equipment between each donor, between each interaction with each donor. We are no longer allowing children on blood drives or at donor centers, as social distancing can obviously be challenging with children. We are holding blood drives, as I said, only in buildings and at donor centers. We're working with the FDA, the CDC, and local public health departments to evaluate and refine our processes. We've actually had multiple communications with the Pennsylvania Department of Health to ensure that we are meeting and exceeding safety requirements and social distancing.
Right now, we have a nation, we have a state, we have a region of people that are a little bit jumpy about where they can go, where they can't go to be safe, social distance, to stay away from anything that surfaces that the virus may have lived on. I would imagine that there are some people that just psychologically don't want to go anywhere having to do with healthcare where there possibly have been some sick people. Is that another hurdle that you're facing?
I think it does present some issues for us. The whole idea of shelter in place, this is for people who have been exposed to the virus or have some direct family contact or something where they may have been exposed. And I think it's very, very confusing. Even during the Dr. Levine's press statement a day or two ago, she opened with donate blood and donate food, which are two great things. But then further into the conversation, she also states that if you don't need to go out, don't go out. But there is information from the FDA that blood drives, the way we are handling them and separating people, that the blood donation process, which is very necessary to protect our nation in, to make sure our blood supply is adequate, that blood donation is safe with how we have it set up. And the blood that people are donating are going to be safe because the coronavirus is not transmitted by transfusion. So people don't have to be concerned that, they could be making someone else sick, so they're not going to want to come out and donate, even though they feel okay.
Yes, this is not an illness that is related to blood transfusions, or really, it's not related to blood. In fact, let me just ask that question. The treatment of coronavirus, the COVID-19 across the country and around the world, is there blood actually needed specifically for that?
I'm not a medical doctor, so I won't say that no patient will be using blood based on their underlying conditions. But this is a respiratory issue. This is a lung issue. And rarely would a patient on a respirator need to have blood. It's not as if they're being dialyzed for a kidney problem or whatever. But it is possible, I guess, that if someone does have kidney problems underlying, that they would need to be transfused. But just we have to also remember that the normal issues of life continue to go on. People may need a transplant, which requires a lot of blood. This morning, when I got into the office, I said to Jay, you know, I woke up this morning thinking about this interview, and I thought to myself, you know, there's mothers that are giving birth today that, you know, never could imagine, you know, 8 or 9 months ago that they would be bringing a newborn baby into a world that's in a pandemic. And birthing mothers and newborn babies often need blood. There's patients that are in the midst of chemotherapy that, you know, probably need to be supported with blood. And then, of course, even though traffic on the roads is less, we still have automobile accidents, and there are people that are working in dangerous jobs to make sure the lights stay on and the water keeps flowing that sometimes can be injured at work. So it's the daily issues that we need to continue to be mindful of that require transfusion.
We have a question from Megan in Lancaster, and I'm sure this is one that a lot of people have. What blood types are most in need?
Right now, we need all blood types. This is unlike any event that I've been in blood banking for almost 30 years, and this is unlike any situation that I have ever experienced. So all blood types are needed. Certainly, if you are group O or Rh negative, they are certainly very needed, but all blood types are needed.
Are there some blood types that, and I imagine you could say this at any time, but maybe especially now, some types that are a little less common than others that you are especially in need of?
O negative, A negative, and B negative. Those are the most, they're the rarest in the general population, but there are people with those blood types that also need transfusion. So those types are definitely needed.
We have another question from Veronica in Harrisburg. Says, are you lowering any criteria for people who would like to donate? And maybe it's a good time to just expand that question. What is the criteria? How many weeks between blood donations? And I know you ask a lot of questions ahead of time. Anything changing there?
No, the FDA has not... has not relaxed any of the requirements, and we continue to use the same questionnaire and interview questions that we have been using for the past several years.
And what are restrictions there, quickly, if you could tick them off? I mean, I travel to other countries, just what?
Travel to certain countries, not all countries, but travel to certain countries. We ask if you've traveled out of the United States in the last 3 years. So we would then screen based on those things. And if people have questions, they can call our 1-800 number and speak to an individual who can walk them through and tell them that, yes, you should come in and give it a try, or no, we would have to defer you. Other requirements, physical requirements, we take your blood pressure and pulse. The first thing we're going to do when a donor walks in to be registered, we're going to take their temperature, and then we're going to go through the series of questions and qualify or disqualify a person from donating.
We had someone who asked, how long between blood donations? Someone gave blood 3 weeks ago. I know that there's a certain period of time between donating.
Yes, there is. It is 8 weeks, 56 days or 8 weeks.
Okay. Tim asks, as a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, I have not been allowed to donate my blood since I returned in 1988. Prior to my service, I was a regular blood donor. Will this restriction be lifted during the emergency?
Again, they have not changed any of the restrictions. But if he would like to call in, that would be a perfect opportunity for him to discuss it if he hasn't discussed it with us within the last 5 years.
How much blood do we need as a nation and also here in central Pennsylvania?
Boy, I don't, you got me on that one. Jay, do you know what the number of units in the United States is?
I don't know the number of the units in the United States. I know that here in central Pennsylvania, we need to collect 200 units of blood a day. We are currently not doing that.
Yeah, what are you collecting today in the last week or so, Jay?
So typically we have about 35 drives a week. Because of cancellations, for safety reasons, et cetera, this week we only had 8 blood drives. We are normally collecting about 1,000 units, 1,000 pints of blood, which are then made into 3 different components, the platelets, the red cells, and the plasma. So we normally collect about 1,000 a week. This week we basically, we're looking at a loss of 26 drives. 26 drives were canceled at a loss of about 708 donations just this week, which means 2,124 blood components that we don't have, that we were planning to have.
All right. Jay and Patrick, I want to give blood today. Where can I go?
The best thing to do and what we're asking everyone to do is to call our number, 1-800-771-0059, and schedule an appointment, or to find us on the web at 717giveblood.org. And there you'll find our phone number, and you can call us, and we have a team ready to find convenient opportunities for anyone who is interested.
All right, I'm going to give a call right after I get off the air. Hey, I want to thank both of you. Patrick Bradley is president and CEO. Jay Weimer is director of community relations for the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank. Thank you for really letting a lot of people know about this situation. Hopefully, a lot of our listeners today will participate, maybe tell other people, and we can get some blood donations going, okay?
That would be great, Scott. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Tonight at 8 on WITF-TV, Confronting Coronavirus, an hour-long special focusing on health precautions for individuals and the public at large, as well as the pandemic's economic impact in both the U.S. and globally. That's tonight at 8 on WITF-TV, Confronting Coronavirus. Nearly all of Pennsylvania's restaurants and bars are closed under the direction of Governor Tom Wolf to keep people from coming in contact with someone who may be infected with the coronavirus. It will create a financial hardship for business owners and thousands of workers who have been laid off from their jobs. Meanwhile, hotels have fewer overnight customers. Joining us now is Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association President and CEO John Longstreet. Mr. Longstreet, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be with you, Scott. How are you today?
I am doing well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Longstreet, the hospitality industry that includes restaurants, bars, taverns, hotels, have been or will be hit hard by the shutdown. Give us a sense of what your members are going through right now.
Well, Scott, they have been hit hard, and there is no playbook for what's happened here. I've been in the business, I hesitate to say, for 50 years, and most of the time either running hotels or restaurants. I've never seen anything like this. Just to give you an example, we thought after the tragedy of September 11, 2001, the hotel industry might never recover. We lost 140,000 employees jobs nationwide. It's now projected that this pandemic will cause a loss of 800,000 to 1 million hotel jobs by the middle of June and 4.6 million in the travel-related industry. So the first concern is for, obviously, our employees, and we're trying to work with not only our members, but all restaurants and hotels around the state. We've made all restaurants and hotels members, essentially, regardless of whether they've paid us dues, because they need our support right now. So the first thing is to try to get help to the employees. You commented that most restaurants are closed. Well, for dining, all restaurants and bars are closed. And they're trying to provide takeout service largely because the consuming public needs it. There's over 51% of the money that's spent on food is spent away from home, and restaurants are a huge part of the food chain. So a lot of restaurants that have never provided takeout or delivery are trying to do so, mostly to keep a few people employed and also to make sure that, our Pennsylvanians can get food so they have something to eat.
Yeah, when I said most, I was including pickup and delivery
right.
in that. Even if ramped up, how much can that make up for as far as pickup and delivery?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Typically, full-service restaurants, which are probably the majority of the restaurants in the state, full-service, or I should say ones that have dine-in options, typically, at best, they're doing 10% of their business on a regular day in takeout business. So that's a small percentage of the overall business they're doing. So how much can that ramp up? It's hard to say. We've been 2 days into this now. I talked with one of our operators yesterday who has about 20 restaurants in Pennsylvania. He estimated that his takeout sales on the first day was maybe double what it was prior to that. But it's hard to say how much it's going to pick up. I talked with an operator last night who had never done takeout, and he did a significant amount of takeout business on Tuesday night, the first night of the first full day of the closure. And again, it's largely as a community service.
There are many variables, including the size of the restaurant, its location. But give us an idea of the people and the jobs that they do and who this affects.
Well, the restaurant industry in Pennsylvania employs 582,000 people. And then put hotels on top of that, there's 122,000. So you can say, well, how many of the restaurant people will be out of work during this crisis? I would say the vast majority of those would be. We don't have actual data yet, as you can imagine, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's three-quarters of those, because of the nature of the jobs in restaurants. There's going to be a skeletal crew. One chain that I'm aware of has a manager coming in each day to prepare the takeout food, and maybe one other person. And this is a restaurant chain that might have had at any given time 50 people working. So you can see the dramatic impact that's going to have on over a 500,000 restaurant workers, and then also in the hotel industry. You mentioned hotels earlier and the dramatic impact that's going to have. I talked with the CEO of a hotel company that has 20 hotels in Pennsylvania. Their typical occupancy system-wide is about 75%. Since this hit, it's about 8%. So you can see, and by the way, in the hotel business, a well-run hotel typically will break even at 50% occupancy. So you can see the dramatic challenge that we have, not only for our employees, but to make sure that when we're through this and the employees want to come back to work, that there are actually places to come back to work to. I just got a note from one of our restaurants that they have closed permanently because they can't see being able to sustain this and get back open afterwards. Our job is to try to get money into the, number one, into the hands of the employees more quickly, mostly through unemployment compensation, and second, to cause our restaurants and hotels to be able to access cash flow so that they can get through this. There's a variety of things we're working on now in that regard, but those are the two key things beyond the first and foremost one, which is to provide for the safety of employees, guests, and the general public.
Well, you mentioned cash flow, and one of the things it reminded me of is that many of your servers, many of the people who work in the restaurant industry rely on tips for most of their income. Are they able to get unemployment compensation, and how is that? I mean, do they get it depending on what they report or just what?
Well, servers, like all servers that get cash tips, are required to report tips. So they're reporting tips that are at least taking them, if they're not reporting all their tips, which we assume they are, they're at least reporting them that take them up to the minimum wage. They have to do that. If not, the restaurant owner has to pay them up to minimum wage. So there is a basis for their unemployment checks that is going to be higher than just the base wage, the base tipped wage that you're speaking of. I should say on unemployment, the key on that is getting it into the hands of the employees quickly. And there's really three things that are required here. One is the waiting period has got to be waived, which we've been able to get that waived. So the 1 week waiting period has been waived. They can essentially get benefits on day one. But currently in Pennsylvania, it could be 3 weeks to a month before they receive the first check. So we're working to try to get that expedited because most hourly workers don't have cash flow for 3 weeks or a month. And then secondly, we've got to make sure the requirement that people have to look for jobs has been waived. That's really important because there are no jobs to look for. And then thirdly, the employers typically take a huge insurance rate hit if they have a high unemployment in their business. So we're trying to get that changed so that they will take no hit during this time period for their employees that are on unemployment, which is going to be the vast majority of restaurant employees.
Something you just mentioned that I'll bet a lot of people haven't thought of is that requirement that you must look for another job while you're getting unemployment compensation, because the point you make is a very good one, that there aren't jobs out there to get. So, yeah, that's a big point. What about food? Is there food going to waste at Pennsylvania restaurants?
Well, I can't say that definitively. I can say that I did talk to, again, a number of our operators who have closed down, some that have closed down entirely because they weren't able to do takeout. And the most typical outlets for their food have been to give them to give prepared food that's already to go to employees to take home, the employees that they're laid off, so that they have some food they can put in the freezer and help get them through this. Second thing is to donate it to local food banks. And food banks are going to be taxed without question. There is a third avenue that we've been working with the Department of Emergency Management on that folks might not have thought of, is that school lunches need to continue to be provided throughout this crisis, because in many cases it's the only good meal that kids are getting. And with grocery stores being taxed, their shelves are in some cases going empty, with food banks depleted supplies. In counties where it's necessary, where we've been asked to, we're connecting the Department of Emergency Management with restaurants who may be able to help provide school meals. So we're trying to do everything we can do to make sure that food doesn't get wasted. The other thing that happens is a restaurant that's going to be closed for a month, which is, I know we're saying technically 2 weeks, but I think most people would say it's not going to be 2 weeks, have to really shut down their coolers and a lot of the equipment, which means they've got to find an outlet for their food today. They can't just hold it until if and when they reopen.
Are there deliveries that are continuing to restaurants? Because we know that, seafood, for example, sometimes is coming on a daily basis. Are there deliveries that continue to be made to restaurants?
They are. The broadliners, the companies like Sysco and U.S. Foods that supply restaurants, are still getting deliveries to restaurants. The one thing that restaurants cannot get is alcohol, or I should say hard liquor or wine. They can still get beer in some cases, and you say, well, why does that matter? A lot of restaurants have wine-to-go permits where they could sell wine out the door, but they can't get wine because the PLCB has shut down for all licensees, and of course they can't sell hard liquor to go anyway, so that's a moot point. But they are getting food, and they can get food. In fact, the broadliners, as you might imagine, to some degree have an excess of food. I've heard of stories, it wasn't in our state, but it was in a neighboring state, where they're trying to connect some of the broadliners. Broadliners would mean a large food distribution company that distributes to restaurants. They're trying to connect them with grocers where they don't have a relationship to help grocers get food on their shelves. So they can get food. They are getting food. But again, their need for food is at best going to be maybe 10 or 15% of what it was before this crisis, with, of course, the exception of the fast food restaurants. But there still are, you're in Harrisburg, I'm in Harrisburg. I feel like I'm the only one downtown today. So people are not out and about, which is the right thing to do.
You know, you touched on this a little bit, John, but once restaurants reopen, will they be fully staffed as they were before? Because there's a good chance that this nation could go into a recession, and that may make some business owners a little bit leery about being fully staffed.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but I think the number of restaurants that are going to reopen is going to be a lot less than the number of restaurants that closed. We were already facing a staffing crisis, not just in the restaurant industry, but in our nation because the unemployment has been so low. If the jobs are lost in the hotel and travel industry that I mentioned, 4.6 million, that one figure would raise the unemployment rate nationwide from 3.5% to 6.3%, just because of the travel industry. So if that actually happens, I hesitate to say, I don't think that our industry is going to have trouble finding people to fill the positions. Let me mention one other thing that I think you may have asked about that I didn't quite answer. In addition to delivery of food to restaurants are delivering to homes. And that's a really good option for folks that are afraid to go out and can't get food. And in fact, some of the major delivery companies like DoorDash have been signing up new restaurants at no charge, without fees. And they're reducing their fees for existing customers. And they have provisions now to essentially do no contact deliveries. And there are provisions that people can take when they get delivered food to try to do their best to make sure that it isn't contaminated too. So that's continuing to be an option. Again, restaurants are reaching out to delivery services. In some cases, they're trying to put their own people to work and creating a delivery program when they didn't have it just to keep people employed.
Yeah, one thing, Mr. Longstreet, I'll say is that I've heard many people say that we're all in this together and that they will make a point of ordering more takeout food, more deliveries, or buying gift cards, for example, to help their local restaurants, businesses, to help those employees, help the restaurant owners. And that's good, too, that people are thinking about that. But the longer this goes, you wonder how much that's going to continue.
Yeah, it's a stressful time for everyone, and I think there's a lot of people, as you well know, we all know, that didn't think this was as serious a situation as it is. I think everyone's that wasn't are finally coming to grips with the idea that it is. As an industry, we knew, as much as we hate to see restaurants and bars closed, we knew that that was critical to the public welfare. And I've had very few, if any, of our restaurants or hotels, hotels are not closed. They're essential businesses, although their dining rooms are closed to on-premise dining, that have complained to me because they had to close. They understand the health need here, and it's going to be the most dramatic impact, of course, is on the employees first, which we're trying to take care of, and secondly, on the businesses. Other ways that we're trying to help them preserve their cash flow, for example, tomorrow, there's sales tax due in the state of Pennsylvania, which is a huge outlay for restaurants and hotels. And in addition to that, state hotel occupancy tax is due. We're trying to get that deferred. I know they're working on it even as we speak to try to get that done by tomorrow. This is going to be so essential to ensuring that employees have a place to go back to work when we get through this.
John Longstreet is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. Mr. Longstreet, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, thanks for helping get the word out.
So I want to talk to someone now who is the owner of a restaurant. Mandy Arnold is co-owner of the Left Bank Restaurant in York, but she also is president and CEO of Gavin Advertising, a communications firm in York. Mandy Arnold, welcome to the program.
Hello, Scott. Thanks for having me today.
So, on the ground, you probably just heard John Longstreet talking about the state as a whole. On the ground, what does this look like for your restaurant?
Well, we made the decision last week before many others and any of the other state-mandated closures to close our restaurant proactively. As a fine dining establishment, we started seeing the impact about 3 weeks ago. Many of our customers are travelers, international travelers, large groups, pharmaceutical companies. And so we truly were on the front lines and started making decisions very quickly We anticipated some things as we watched the markets in China and then Seattle. And so my husband and I started putting some measures into place actually a couple weeks ago.
Well, like what?
Well, what we started doing was taking a look at how do we adjust some of our orders, how do we adjust some of our staffing levels to make it through what we anticipated to be an initial round of sales declines. But what we didn't anticipate was the rapid pace of the declines. We literally saw from week one, 3 weeks ago, some cancellations and people noting that it was because of COVID-19, to the next week where we were down 50%, to the next week we would actually only have one group in a dining room and we seat 120 people. So we were forced to make decisions quickly. And as we were taking a look at cash flow, as the gentleman earlier was stating, you know, if we don't get ahead of it, we won't be able to reopen. And so we knew that this was a very, very serious situation we had to deal with quickly.
Now, when you say that if we don't get ahead of it, that we wouldn't be able to reopen, do you mean that mm-hmm. literally, or are you talking about how what worst case scenario could be?
Well, what we meant by getting ahead of it was two things. One, public safety. We see this restaurateurs have a responsibility to understand the role we play in a social community. We know that every interaction we have with someone in the public, we're putting people at risk. And so we wanted to get ahead of it ourselves and say, how do we send the right signal to our community that we need to close our doors, one, for public safety? That was the first part. The second part was understanding how do we protect the business financially. So how do we take a look at the cash flow that we have today? Restaurant margins are very, very slim. And when you look at fine dining restaurants, the margins are even more slim. If we're making 2-3%, we're in a good spot in fine dining. So you can imagine what a hit it looks like financially when all of a sudden 50-75% of your sales aren't coming through the door.
How many people do you employ?
At the restaurant, 27 staff. This was certainly painstaking as we went through the decision-making process very quickly. And again, we were the first ones to close, certainly in the region. I think a lot of people thought we had lost our minds. But we spent a lot of time across all of our businesses studying the markets and financials, and we had, fortunately, some small window of foresight at what was coming at us because we had been watching China and Seattle. But we knew that we needed to proactively get our staff on unemployment, making sure that they were in touch with the benefits and resources that were available. So our operations teams across all of the companies decided to jump in very, very quickly.
I'm curious, as I mentioned, you also are the president and CEO of Gavin Advertising Communications. Mm-hmm. You have vast experience in crisis communications. That industry, how has that industry been impacted by this?
Sure. So I will say I've been very busy. Crisis communications is actually my area of expertise. That's how our organization got started. I think that was one of the advantage points we had, as much as we could have an advantage with the restaurant within our portfolio. For Gavin, we are fielding all sorts of calls. We've proactively taken measures by communicating with our clients. And how should you be evaluating not only proactive communications on safety measures with your employees and customers, but what do you do when you have your first presumptive positive case? We do a lot of work in healthcare, education, government, as well as the services industries. And what we're now preparing for, we're seeing it happen, is that everyone from a member of the leadership team to someone that is interacting with customers on a daily basis may come back with a positive test. And there's a level of public safety responsibility that each company has in communicating. The one thing that we're talking to all of our clients about is that everyone's in the same boat right now. And this is about if you manage the communications the right way, you will likely be judged more for how you manage your communications process than the fact that this virus hit your company, because everyone's dealing with that.
Mandy Arnold is the co-owner of the Left Bank Restaurant in York, and she also is president and CEO of Gavin Advertising and Communications. Ms. Arnold, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. And I also want to tell you about what's coming up tonight on WITF-TV, Confronting Coronavirus, an hour-long special focusing on health precautions for individuals and the public at large, as well as the pandemic's economic impact in both the U.S. and globally. That's tonight at 8 on WITF-TV. One of the most sacred of rituals, funerals, are being affected by the coronavirus precautions. Joining us now is David Peek, president of the Pennsylvania Funeral Directors Association. He also is a licensed funeral director. Mr. Peek, welcome to the program.
How are you, Scott? Thank you for having me.
I'm doing well. So the big question, how are funerals being impacted by what's going on right now?
Well, I think our norm has been impacted immensely. Just trying to follow the guidelines and guidance that our state, local, and federal officials have said about social gathering and social distancing. So, you know, we are trying to limit the amount of exposure that the families that we work with and the other people coming to pay their respects would have. So we're trying to limit this. We're trying to be a leader in the community and lead by example in social distancing.
So how are you doing that? What are some of the limits?
Well, at this point, we are working with the families in which we are serving to put together a meaningful service to meet any of their religious rites in the immediate time after the passing of a loved one, and also trying to explore options to have a memorial service or gathering at a later date when circumstances dictate.
So, okay, here's a question. Maybe it's out of left field, but how long can someone hold off on actual burial? I guess the blunt question is, how long can a funeral director hold on to a body before actually it's being interred?
Sure, that's a good question, and that's a question that many families have asked, the funeral directors and a lot of different people are asking. Estate law says final disposition, meaning an individual needs to be buried or cremated within 10 days of passing. We can ask for an extension of that time through the State Board of Funeral Directors, and we have been in constant contact with the State Board, and they are willing to work with each individual funeral home for those circumstances.
And by the way, if you have a question or a comment from David Peek, Jr., president of the Pennsylvania Funeral Directors Association, you can give us a call. We have about 7 minutes left, so give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Understand that many funeral homes, and I don't know whether this is what has been decided or if this is just something that is an agreement, but limiting attendance at services to 10 people. Is that written in stone?
No, it is not, nothing is written in stone. But again, you know, following the guidelines that the federal government, the state government, and our local governments are saying, is that they're saying that we should social distance or limit gatherings to 10 people. And on any given day, Scott, you know, I'm sure you've been to many funerals throughout your life, is that on any given day, a funeral home could have 50 to 500 people coming through. You know, we are members of our community, and public health and public safety are one of our staples that we try to live by here. And who are we to say that we are going to move forward with having a funeral and putting the families in which we are serving at risk and those people that are coming out to show outwardly actions of sympathy to the family, you know, who are we to put them at risk as well? I think everybody needs to take a look at themselves and realize that we as Americans and Pennsylvanians, we need to take an active role in trying to, as they say, flatten the curve. And by allowing large groups of people getting together, I don't think that that meets the goals of what we need to do right now at this point in time.
Well, obviously, I don't have to tell you, but and I think that most people realize that when we're talking about a funeral, people are vulnerable at that point. They've just lost a loved one, and it's not like a wedding where you've planned for it all your life, but at the same time, it is a ritual that many people have planned, and emotionally, people are raw. Funeral directors, I have always been amazed at how you have worked with your clients, the families, and just the right emotional tone and how to work with people, but it must be especially a challenge now, is it?
It is. You know, as a licensed funeral director for 20 years here in the Commonwealth, you know, our sympathies and, you know, my sympathy goes out to each and every individual in which I serve. You know, and now that they're experiencing the loss of a loved one and having to go through the burden of grief during these uncertain times, it just adds that extra level and that extra layer to the grieving process, you know. But, you know, our job as funeral directors is to walk with the bereaved through the grieving process. You know, our funeral homes here in the Commonwealth, you know, are professional. They're in you know, intuitive. They will be able to work with each individual family in which they're serving to put together the service that works for them. You know, I know people aren't maybe not always going to listen to the guidelines that the government puts out. We want to try and be part of the solution and not try to have the COVID-19 virus continue for months on end.
Now, does that mean that there are families that are, as you say, working with them, that besides interment, that you're talking about more memorial services once this has died down somewhat?
Well, sure. By definition, a memorial service is a service without a body, okay? So, you know, if we need to meet the requirements of the law and have disposition of burial, we can do that with the immediate family by, you know, having a small gathering for the family, allowing the family to have that time with their loved one. And at a later date, when circumstances are better, you know, we can have a more public, more open memorial service for the friends, family, and communities to come out and grieve and pay their respects with that family.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We've actually received several questions along this line.
Okay.
Are funeral directors getting special instructions on how to handle a body? Are there any specifications dealing with handling bodies that may have been exposed to or people who have passed away from COVID-19?
Well, we are following the CDC recommendations for handling a decedent. And again, we are at all times using universal precautions, and we are well aware of the situation that is going on. But we are following the CDC's recommendations. And, you know, as you know, this situation is very fluid. Those recommendations and numbers and things are changing by the day, by the hour. So, you know, we are trying to keep our members as up to date as possible as we can. The information that we are getting is we're disseminating out to our members.
So is this different, though, from maybe those who have died of communicable disease in the past?
I think we're all finding that out as we move forward here. Like I said, you know, we're finding things out about this virus daily. You know, new information. You know, I've heard statistics that, you know, the virus can live on surfaces anywhere from 2 hours to 9 days. I mean, so there's a wide range. But we as funeral directors treat every decedent equally with universal precautions and taking the community's well-being into consideration with dealing with a deceased individual.
I guess the bottom line is, and I only have about 30 seconds, is can the public feel secure and confident when they are, unfortunately, the loss of a loved one, that the funeral director, the people working with that decedent, is safe and hasn't been exposed to the virus?
You can. Like I said, we as funeral directors, we take the community health very seriously. We take our own health very seriously. And we want to you know, keep everyone's safety in the forefront. And I just want to let the general public know that their loved one will not be forgotten, and that the funeral will not take place. We are available, and we will honor their loved one in the best way possible.
David Peake, President, Pennsylvania Funeral Directors Association, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Scott. Thank you for having me.